All right, folks, this is another episode of the Lane 8 BMX podcast. And I have someone on here that I have bought product from. I have someone on here that I have considered to be the mad genius of BMX, and that is George Costa of Renin Design Group. And I want to say thanks to George for giving me some time. Thank you, George.
Yeah, no worries. Glad to do the podcast. So
sweet, sweet. Okay, here's my my first question to you is this. I know you have obviously a business involved in BMX, but you were a BMXer yourself.
Yeah, at many moons ago, yeah. You know, I started BMX quite late. I didn't learn how to ride a bicycle until I was 9 years old. Wow. And it was kind of funny. My parents are from Portugal, from Azores. So they're immigrants here in the United States. And for Christmas, when I was 9, I had gotten a Huffy. Actually, I have it actually here. I have the frame. All I have left is the frame, but it's hanging up on the wall behind me. It was like a full straight up 20 inch, like I forget the model, like pro certified or whatever it was. One of the cheap ones you could get like at Kmart or something like that. And, but I remember being super embarrassed because I was 9 years old and I didn't know how to ride a bike, and I had training wheels on this thing, and there was a parking lot, around the block from where my parents lived. And I would go over there when no one was around and try to learn. I felt like all my friends knew how to ride a bike, but I didn't. But then when I did, and I it's all I wanted to do. So, I think what really attracted me to bicycles and bike racing and stuff was BMX Plus magazine, because there was a local, it was called Tiverton News in Rhode Island. I lived on the border of Massachusetts and Rhode Island, in a city called Fall River. But there was a news shop, magazine, newspaper store,
yep.
Which is wild to think about that places like that actually existed. But
I actually worked at a newsstand in college in Atlanta. I did.
Oh, really?
Yes, yeah. Sir.
Well, I was a paper boy.
Same here.
Yeah. So this is a little bit of a side story, but kind of goes into like, I guess, work ethic, but I came home from first grade and had learned at school about all of my friends in first grade had allowances. And I asked my parents, I asked my dad, I was like, hey, you know, these kids at school get money every week. Like, they get an allowance. Can I get an allowance? And my dad, in broken English, he was like, yeah, you want money? I'll get you money. Don't worry about it. He went and literally talked to the local guy who would drop off the bundles of newspapers and stopped him and said, hey, if a newspaper route opens up, let me know because I want it for my son. And, you know, at 6 years old, like a newspaper route opened up. And I ended up doing that goddamn paper route for like 9 years. But my parents helped me. But there were years where, you know, once I got older, like I had like 150 papers, I think. I did like basically this project next to my house, but the Sunday papers,
yep.
I mean, we would have like a 3-foot wall that was 15 feet long that would get dropped off in front of my house. And when I got like punished or when my parents were pissed at me, I used to have to do it on my bike and like wrapping. It was like one bundle at a time, ride down to the project, go into the building, distribute like 6 or 8 papers, come back and go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. But normally we would just toss them in my dad's truck and drive from building to building. And I would run through and, you know, drop them off. But yeah, so I've always worked since I was a little kid and, you know, just looking to buy stuff and spend your money and everything. You know, I'd go to the local magazine store, and BMX Plus like really stood out to me. There were two magazines that I bought a lot when I was a kid. One of them was BMX Plus. The other one was Ninja Magazine. I don't know if you remember that one.
Oh, yes, I do. Yes, I do. Wow.
So those were, that was my path. I was either going to be a ninja or I was going to be something related with BMX.
Okay,
so
you could be both. Yeah.
Ninja didn't work out. So
apparently not. Tell me this. When you had your paper route, did you ever use the big yellow carts that they used to have where you could push them?
No.
You could put the, I'd have to.
Yeah, we never did that.
Dude, we had to do that. I'm from Minnesota, so I would have to use the big yellow cart in the winter. Yeah. And drag that thing around delivering papers.
Yeah, no. For us, it was really just loaded up in the back of my dad's truck and drive through. And he'd stop from like building to building. I mean, it was an easy route because it was this project that had like standard like concrete building with probably each hallway had probably four apartments above, two floors, kind of gang together. And you would go like everyone, whoever I had, but you had to memorize the route, all that stuff. And then collect and people not answering their door and then making a list and all this stuff. And it's just kind of funny. But I mean, it did. One thing that it absolutely taught me was, like, if you wanted anything in life, like, you have to work for it and you have to work hard. And that's 100% something that's translated all the way to you know, nowadays. And I do that with my kids, too. Like, I have my kids working in the shop and they help do different things. And my son's actually running the machines behind me for engraving gears. And he will also run the lathe and maintain parts coming off of it and stuff. So trying to teach them both. You know, and they get paid obviously. But you know, just trying to teach them from a young age, like, hey, if you want something, you know, you have to go work for it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And a lot of these things have been coming up recently too. Cause, it was kind of funny. My son in the fall had asked me to go buy some sneakers and like, I'm not like a sneakerhead. I'm not like that person anymore. Like I'll wear the same shit for a long time. And wear it out. But you know, we go and you know, it was this store. I should have known better because all the sneakers were wrapped in saran wrap.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
it was pretty hilarious. So you know, we're there, we're all there, and he found a set that he wants, and it was these SB Dunks. And he's like, yeah, I want to get these, Dad. And I'm like, okay, fine. No prices on them. I'm like, all right, whatever. And we go to the register.
Yep.
And we're at the register. And the lady's like, yeah, it's $320. And I'm like, okay. Now, I probably, if my kid didn't work, I probably should have been reasonable and said, like, no, you're not. Like, get out of here. Like, what are you, crazy?
Yeah.
You know? But I used it as a moment to like tell him, and he was like looking at me. He was like, "Dad, I'll use money from my bank account, you know." And I'm like looking at him, and I'm like, you know, all those times when I ask you to come do something, and you kind of give me a hard time, like you want to go play video games instead or whatever, but you do it and you kind of suck it up. He's like, "Yeah." I said, "It's for times like this. So you have the money, but I'm not going to take it from you, but." This is why we do what we do. You know, if you want something and it's something that you want, you can go ahead and buy it, you know?
That's not bad.
And we did that. Yeah, I did that. And it's just kind of funny, but you know, it's little things like that are coming up.
Yeah.
Whereas if when I was a kid, my parents wouldn't even let me, they'd be like, get the hell out of here. So
my mom would have said the same thing, dude. So I understand. So don't.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me ask you this. When was your first BMX race and where was it? And how did you do?
Okay. So are we talking like official sanctioned or
yes,
just
sir.
Racing a bicycle?
No, official sanctioned.
Ah.
Okay. Well, the bicycle. No, let's go back. Let's go. If the story for racing the bicycle is more interesting, give me that one.
We'll be right back.
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy?
And what if I told you you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we are the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
I don't actually remember my first sanctioned race, but my first ever bicycle race.
Yeah.
Because I delivered newspapers, my mom saw in the local newspaper that they were going to have a bicycle race at this local park in town. And I was so excited to do it. And I showed up, I was like ready to go. And I saw all these kids who I, a few years later, became friends with all of them. But I saw them and they were all decked out on the nicest bikes. Like, I saw like a Free Agent. I'm not sure if the guy with the Rev Core was there, but there was like all these like a Hutch, like you see the bike and you, and especially back in those days, and they have number plates on. And I'm like, I'm gonna lose like big time. Well, none of those guys entered because to them it was probably stupid because it was a bunch of little kids, or kids my age. I don't remember exactly how old I was, but it was like a bunch of cones in a parking lot and 1 foot start, and I won, and I still have that trophy. And my mom brought me to that race. Yeah,
that's pretty good.
Damn. So it was that was pretty cool. It's I have it actually right next to. The factory title cups for Ansa Renan.
Yeah.
Cause that is my official first ever race in, it wasn't sanctioned, but it's the one that's most memorable. I don't even remember the first time I remember going, but I don't remember what I got or anything like that. And then when I was 15 is the year I really took things a lot more seriously.
You got pretty good too.
So what?
You got pretty good too.
I did okay. I mean, I didn't race a long time when I was younger. So I think 14, I think I started officially like sanctioned BMX racing at 14.
Yeah.
And at that age, I went from rookie to expert in one season. And got rookie of the year at my local track. It was Rocky Hill in East Greenwich, Rhode Island. That was where I always raced was Rhode Island. Even though I'm from Massachusetts, I'm like so close to the border that was the local track for me. I got rookie of the year when I was 14. And then 15 was like the big year. Like I was expert. There was a local guy, good friend of mine. His name is Davey Maltesos. He was nationally ranked. He was national number two and national number three in 15 expert. He used to like battle with Robbie Miranda and Randy Stumpfhauser.
Yeah.
But locally, he battled with me. So like at that 15 year age, him and I would go back and forth. And I'm still like bigger than him, but when we were younger. You know, I was much, much taller than him. He was 15 years old and he still had 1 3/8 wheels. Wow. And he had this clapped out Titan that he always snapped and always would like re-weld it and stuff like that. And, but he was super fast. And, yeah. but at my local track, we would go back and forth. I'd win a race. He'd win a race. I'd win a race. He'd win a race. And we went all year like that. And it came down to the very last race of the state championship. And we were tied in points. And basically whoever won the state championship and I won. And that's probably my hardest accomplishment that I've gotten in anything in BMX. Cause I never tried so hard in my life. I everything kind of, not that it went downhill from there, but,
It's
just, I'm not as natural as a lot of these other guys. And then at 16 years old, I decided to do the national series.
Yep.
And I didn't do any ABA. We were all NBL kids. I forget how many races I did that year, but finishing out the 1993 Grands, I was ranked 16th in 16 Expert and 8th in 16-17 Cruiser.
Yeah.
And that qualified me for the next year for Waterford Oaks, Michigan for the Worlds.
The Worlds. Okay.
And that was my senior year of high school, and I literally, I don't even think I touched my bike all year. Yeah, because when I was a senior, I went to a vocational high school, so I only had 2 years of academics. I had 2 years of electricity shop, so I was, you know, training to be an electrician. But in my junior year, you get to do this thing called like working on the house. Which, yep. So the school always builds a house every year for somebody.
Yeah.
And you go work on it and wire it up and everything. And like I learned during my junior year that I don't like working outside in the winter. Like, you know, especially like being an electrician, you can't have gloves on really. Your hands are freezing. You're doing all this stuff. So I had had a substitute teacher who was a mechanical engineer. And it was he was a substitute teacher for our electrical theory class. And he told us these stories. He didn't teach us anything about electrical theory. He told us stories about his job. And I thought it was so interesting. And found out that he was doing mechanical engineering. At the same time, I worked at a bike shop. And one day, a guy comes in asking for like a really weird, it was a really large diameter front derailleur, like a really large tube.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd said to him, like, what the hell do you want that for? That's super hard to find. Like, we don't have anything like that. And he, you know, wanting to talk about his project, he's like, oh, I'm a mechanical engineering student at University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. And I designed a full suspension mountain bike. He's like, you want to see it? It's out in my trunk. And I'm like, yeah, I want to see it. Cool. So we walk out to his car and he pulls out this bike that he made at the school. And I almost burst out laughing. I was like, wow, this is a huge piece of shit. Like, I could probably make something better right now. Cause I was always like handy and like I modified a lot of stuff growing up. And I was known for that. Like in 92, like my bike of choice was a Cyclecraft Pro XLX, but I had probably one of the only Cyclecrafts on the East Coast that had, I had welded on V-brake mounts and did all kinds of trick stuff to it and stuff. Yeah. So, you know, I knew that was probably this mechanical engineering thing sounds pretty cool. Like this is a good path.
Yeah.
So my senior year of high school, because I didn't have good grades at all leading up to that point, I was like, all right, I got to try to get good grades now. I got to do something because I got to try to get in. And that's when I stopped BMX racing pretty much because I kind of focused on high school to get like, you know, straight A's if I could, so that when I apply, I could have a hope of getting in. And I only applied to one school. I applied to UMass Dartmouth and actually applied for this program that they have there. It's called College Now.
Yeah.
It's for minority students, basically. And the way their criteria to get accepted is low income, parents are from another country, and like English is a second language at home.
Yeah.
So you had to hit two of the three criteria, and I hit two of them right off the bat. I had English as a second language at home, my parents speak Portuguese, and you know, my parents are from the Azores, from Portugal. So that got me in, and basically it was a one semester program that if you took all these like basic classes, like basic business math and basic like science and basic English and stuff like that. And if you could pass that, they would admit you directly into the major of your choice. It was pretty good because I only had 2 years of academics. And at my high school, I had 2 years of shop experience and 2 years of basically becoming an electrician under my belt. But, you know, trying to go the college route is pretty hard.
Yeah.
And, but I was always like hustling and, when I went to school, like BMX racing taught, it kind of got ingrained in me that you get the magazine, you're going to plan out your national schedule. You say, okay, I can afford to go to this many races. I'm going to go here. I'm going to go here. I'm going to go here.
Yep.
So when you go to college and you get the course catalog and you're like, all right, these are the classes I need to take. I can't take this class until I take this class. So I got to make sure that this is offered at these times. And I like mapped everything out. I caught an issue, which was going to be trying to take calculus one, because having gone to the vocational high school, I never had geometry or trigonometry.
Oh.
And the business math that we were in, it was like pre-calc. That it was like business pre-calc. The teacher that I had, luckily she was really cool. And I said, you know, I need to try to get into calc one. Is there any way that you would let me? And I had gotten an A in the pre-cal class. And she's like, did you have trigonometry and geometry? I'm like, no. And she's like, okay. She was Polish, and in a thick Polish accent, she said, you know, you go to Barnes and Noble, you buy this book and read it over the winter and come back in. I give you tests. If you pass it, I admit you to calc one. And I'm like, all right, no problem. Mm-hmm. So I did that and I passed and I got into calc one. So at my high school, there was 240 kids that graduated. My ranking was 120. I was right in the middle of 240 kids. But kids that were in the top 10,
yeah,
a lot of them went to UMass Dartmouth, and they were all in like electrical engineering and stuff like that. There were friends of mine in the top 10 that didn't get, like they didn't have that one teacher that like changed the course of things for me. And they were forced to take another like pre-calc that would let them take calc,
yeah,
and then move on.
Yeah.
I graduated 6 months ahead of them, and they were ranked in like, one of the kids was ranked like fourth in at my high school, and I was ranked 120.
Okay. So the name of your high school, tell me if I've got this wrong. It's Diamond Regional Vocational Technical High School.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay. So is, you went to UMass Dartmouth. Is that the same Dartmouth that I'm thinking about?
No. Dartmouth is, I think it's in Vermont or New Hampshire. That's the Ivy League school, Dartmouth.
Yeah.
UMass Dartmouth is University of Massachusetts Dartmouth. So there's five campuses, I believe. There's Amherst, Lowell. Amherst has like the good Division I basketball team. There's Lowell. There's Boston. There's a bunch of them, but typical state school.
Yeah, but you did, when it came to your master's, you didn't just go to your typical state school.
Yeah. So
now, this is the one that's blowing my mind, because if we're talking about a kid that's 120th out of 240 students in high school.
Yeah.
And then he gets his master's at MIT.
Yeah.
Okay. So my question to you is this: what was the change? Because MIT is not an easy school to get into.
It's definitely not an easy school to get into. It is just as hard as all the others. It was just as hard, yeah, as UMass Dartmouth. So, yeah, like getting there, there was more anxiety about getting there and like doubting yourself, you know, and because you don't know any of the stuff till you go through it.
Yeah.
I mean, luckily, like one thing that BMX teaches you, if you get to a point of getting good, you undoubtedly end up talking shit to your friends, to like me and Davey, like, God, we still talk shit. I was just rode with him last weekend. Like, you know, so having that, I think, helped when you go to a place that's super intimidating. Like you're going to the number one engineering school in the world.
In the world.
Yeah. And certainly it was not easy, but it was very doable. And, I mean, I think I graduated, with like A minuses, like in B's there. But it wasn't even that hard, because at the end of the day, there was only three semesters of actual coursework that I had to do. And then there was my thesis for my master's.
Okay.
And, you know, that was a funny story too, because, you know, just like when I started UMass Dartmouth and I mapped out like my national schedule of classes, when I got to MIT, I did the same exact thing. I had a good routine down, and I start mapping everything out, and I'm like, in the first few weeks, I'm like, oh, like I'm going to be done in a little bit over a year. And I had gone to my advisor, and I had asked him, I said, hey, I don't see like definite requirements to stay for a PhD, and I'm interested, like, what, how does that work? You know, can you explain that to me? And he starts asking me all kinds of questions. And he's like, well, you know, if that's kind of hard because you have a board, and your thesis board dictates like when you graduate, because you have to do this defense. And he's like, yeah, some people take 5 years, some people take 7 years. I mean, I have somebody who's been here for 9 years. Wow. And I was like, yeah, no thanks. Immediately. And he was like, why? What, when do you think you're graduating? And I said, well, nothing in the course syllabus is going to prevent me from getting out in a little bit over a year. And he laughed at me, and he was like, there's no way that you're going to finish your master's degree in 3 semesters. He's like, it's not possible. And I was like, why? And he's like, it's just how it goes. And I said, well, how long does it typically take? And he said, there's people who typically on average, they finish in 3 years.
Wow.
And I said, there's no way. And he's like, he told me, he said, I'll tell you what, if you think that you'll have your thesis done by the start of the last semester, I'll graduate you regardless. And I said, challenge accepted.
You weren't playing around.
Yeah, I had everything. I had everything ready to go. So, you know, I took the classes I needed to take. My research was working with, working for Caterpillar Corporation.
Yeah.
And they had resident scientists in our lab. So, you know, got to know them real well and, you know, did all of the requirements that Caterpillar had asked. Caterpillar was paying for my education. They were paying. I was getting a stipend. So I was getting, it wasn't much money. Trust me. It was $1,100 a month in 1999. And I had to live on that. Yeah. I ended up taking out like a $10,000 loan just so that I could get an apartment off campus, because I didn't want to live with anybody. So I wanted to get my own place, and there was like 0 one-bedroom dorms available. So I just got an off campus apartment in Somerville, and yeah, just dealt with that. But I mapped everything out, planned everything out, got all of my my thesis was very experimental, so yeah. I had to build this whole experiment basically for Caterpillar, and conducted all of the testing in the first like few weeks in January of 2000, and wrote the thesis like a week and a half later. Wrote the whole thing, submitted it to Caterpillar. They went through it, reviewed it, made a couple of edits back and forth. I turned it in. I turned in the thesis to my advisor, and he just kind of looks at me and kind of didn't pay any attention. I'm like, okay, my job's done, and went about my way. And I had taken extra classes and stuff, so my last semester was really light. I only had like 2 classes, so I stopped going to the lab. And just didn't show up anymore. I only went to school like when I had class. And after about a week or maybe a week and a half, my advisor calls me up, and he's like, "Hey, is everything okay?" And I'm like, "Yeah, why?" And he's like, "I haven't seen you in the lab." And I'm like, "I don't know why I would go there. I'm done." And he's like, "What do you mean you're done?" I said, "I turned in my thesis to you. What else is there for me to do?" And he's like, "Get back in here tomorrow. We have to have a meeting." Okay, fine. I'm just at my computer in the lab. I see him walk by. He throws this stack of paper on my desk, and it says, "Congratulations."
Dang.
And I was done. So
that's it.
Yeah, that was it. And then that was like early in the semester. So then basically, I did whatever, like there were some presentations that we had to do for Caterpillar and things like that. Flew out to Illinois, flew to North Carolina for some stuff. But yeah, and then it was done. And then it was like, okay, now I got to find a job. So I got to figure out what I'm going to do.
Okay. So that's my question. So did you automatically, once you finished, when you went to find a job, did you go directly into mechanical industrial engineering, or did you think of the thought of starting a business of your own?
No, I went straight into a defense contractor job. So there's a company called Draper Laboratory that was, it spun out of MIT. So Doc Draper was a professor at MIT who is the father of inertial navigation. So what that means is, using like electromechanical means to measure properties of acceleration, velocity, mm-hmm. and doing the math in electronics to compute position. And what you could use that for is guidance systems for missiles. So they developed this at MIT. They developed it in like the 50s. A lot of the stuff that they did helped win like the war. And then they spun off a whole, it's a big non-for-profit. There's like 1,000 engineers that work there, but it's like a stone's throw from MIT. So I started working there, and I worked in for the Navy. I split my time kind of half and half, half for the Navy working on the Trident Mark VI nuclear missile system. So what I did on that, it was a job more of, you know, the Trident Mark VI is, I think, right now, I mean, it's been a while, so it could be different, but it used to be at the time, like, it was the nation's, like, nuclear armament. It was, like, in all of the submarines and things like that, all designed in, like, the 80s, and it was all, like, Reagan money, so there was, I mean, the place I worked at, in the 80s, they had more money than they knew what to do with. But what happens is all of that stuff gets made back in the 80s. It gets implemented. Now you got to make sure you know that it can keep on working. And if there's an issue, if there's a systems test that fails, like failure is not an option for that discipline. I remember like one of my first jobs ever was that in one of like the inspections or something that they had done on one of these missiles, that there was a circuit that wasn't working correctly, and they literally tracked it down to like a little tiny capacitor on a circuit board, a little like square ceramic capacitor, and they had determined that it was cracked, and they didn't know why, and they had asked me to try to come up with scenarios of how that could possibly happen, either in manufacturing or in running. And that's like the only thing that we could really come up with was like a thermal issue, like when you're soldering it, you know, if you don't solder it correctly and the heat and the stress. So that part of my job was 100% like computer simulation models. So it's called finite element analysis. So you build a model in the computer of all the components, and you apply heat, stress, displacements, things like that. And you let the computer solve this, all these equations. And then you get these like nice color maps and stuff. And I use it nowadays for the products that we design. I use those finite element methods on everything that we do pretty much.
Okay. Let me ask you this. Did you enjoy the work?
In the beginning, yeah, absolutely. I think it was fresh and new. But then, and you want to like make a difference, but then you start realizing like what's going on in this place. Like you do all this work and all this stuff happens, and they're like, you have this big meeting, I present it in front of admirals and things like that, and they're like, yeah, all right, good. And then it's like we move on to the next thing, and nothing really. It was like, it felt like I was constantly like just like doing these exercises, like nonstop, like homework assignments. Right.
Yeah.
And it took me a couple of years to realize that it's sustainment. The guys that designed all of this hardware in the 80s, they're retiring or they're dying. So you need to maintain the next generation of engineers that know how to work on the stuff in case the shit hits the fan and there is a real problem, then you could dive in and figure it out. And that is like what is going on right now, is just continuous sustainment. Because the stuff that they designed is good for decades, you know?
So what made you walk away from that? I'm curious.
When I tried to apply to MIT, when I applied to MIT and I got accepted, I really wanted to work in robotics, because during my time at UMass Dartmouth, I worked at Titleist and FootJoy. I worked in research and development at Titleist, and I got pretty good at building electromechanical systems. So programming little computers that run machines or do things. And I really cut my teeth in that at Titleist. And I wanted to get into robotics. Took a bunch of robotics classes at UMass Dartmouth and stuff. And when I went looking for a research assistantship, nobody had any money, because robotics was like, it was cool, but it's not like it is now. Okay. So couldn't get a research assistantship, and I didn't have the 34 grand at that time that it costs to go to MIT.
Yeah.
I think now it's like 72, but it didn't have that. So I was relying on finding an advisor who had research money. And, these advisors, like, they have the lists of kids that get accepted, and they start cold calling and saying, hey, looking at your resume, it'd be good to have you join my lab. So my advisor had called me, and it was in the fluid mechanics department. And that was like the furthest thing from what I wanted to do. Like, I did not want to do fluid mechanics. It's a very, very hard, difficult topic that is, it's very theoretical to some extent, and very like super high order math. And I was a little skeptical, and I told him, like, I'm really trying to find a robotics research assistantship. And he said, yeah, robotics is cool and all, but they're broke. And I got tons of money. And I'm like, all right, cool. And I had to make a decision fast, because, like, I got accepted and basically I had like maybe 3 weeks to figure it out and find an apartment and do all that stuff. So I chose to go the fluid mechanics route. When I got the job at Draper, same thing. Draper has a robotics division, and they have this Navy division. They have all these other, they have a bunch of different divisions there. And my thought was that I would get in, and if the Navy department was like looking for people. It was like, do you breathe? Like, come on in. You know, that was kind of like, take a pulse, you know? So I got that job. I thought it was cool. I learned a lot about using that simulation software. But after, like I said, a couple of years in, it starts getting like, you know, this is sustainment. Like, nothing that I do really matters. And that's when I started really pushing towards the robotics division at Draper. And I spent I spent 6 years there. I spent half of my time doing Navy work. I spent half of my time doing robotics. So we had two major projects that we worked on there. One was a flapping wing airplane, kind of like internally developed, to have, like, could we make an aerial vehicle that flaps its wing like like a bird? Wow. And I have one video of like a controlled descent. So we did fly it for maybe like 200 feet, but, you know, that was all internally funded and never moved on from that point in time. But another one that was internally funded was a snake-like robot. And myself and another guy fully designed and built about a 6 or 7 foot long snake-like robot that we had full control over everything. And that one has a very impressive video that we have of it sidewinding across the shop floor. And that one project, that one video, the project internally, I think it cost, Draper's a non-for-profit, so they take their massive profits that they get and they have to reinvest. So they reinvested through these innovative research and development projects. Yeah. So they basically they solicit to their engineers, hey, you got an idea you want to work on? And if it kind of fits like strategically for pitching it as a bigger project,
yeah,
they'll let you do it, which is really cool. So we, you know, when the first Snake robot, I think it cost around $250,000 to develop.
What world?
But that turned into a $5 million DARPA program. And it went from two people designing and building a robot that was pretty cool. But it's like a big, almost like a big RC Snake. But that video that we produced was good enough and convinced DARPA to give us a $5 million contract. And that funded about 72 engineers at the company. Now, this was like, this was a massive undertaking. And I was the mechanical engineering lead, the team lead on that project. Like everything about that vehicle was like, came from my, idea creation. We integrated a lot of things, some things that MIT had done. I think that we were the first to like some unique drivetrain stuff. And then there was a big contest. So DARPA, had this Snake robot challenge where they gave out a couple of million dollars to like five different companies, and they all were building versions, and we had a like obstacle course we had to go through. And some of it was kind of crazy, like climbing a flagpole, traversing like a 1 foot gap, all this kind of stuff. And we went down to this test facility, and I think it was San Antonio, to do all the testing. And we're there with the other teams, and we approached it from like a pure, like, we're going to build something very, very snake-like. And then you had these other teams that were like, we're going to build something to win. And it's like, shit. So they built something that looked like a snake robot, but on the bottom had like 32 wheels. And they would just drive across the ground. And so that was pretty lame when we came up upon that. So the goal with these kind of like DARPA funded programs is that was called like a phase one.
Yeah.
Phase one is kind of lower money. Like, I know it sounds crazy, but like 5 million. A phase two might get you like 15 to 20 million. A phase three is like 100 million type of deal. Like basically once you're at that point, you have something that they're trying to transition into like the military, you know?
Okay.
And obviously I think for them, if they could get something and shrink the technology down, because one of the, you know, anywhere you go in the world, the one system that is open to penetration essentially is a sewer line.
Okay.
So
that my next question was going to ask you, like, a system like that, what would you have used it for?
Yeah, it's basically surveillance. So you some kind of like covert operation or something like that. You have, and what's funny is halfway through the program, there used to be this TV show. I forget what the name of it was, but it was like kind of like a Black Mirror kind of show. But I remember the episode, we all freaked out about this episode because obviously Hollywood made snake robots look like way cooler than what we could do. And we were midway through, and there was an episode of a hostage situation in a mosque. And they had brought in like the nerdy engineer guys, and he had like an RC like controller.
Yep.
And they break out this snake robot that's like 4 feet long and like maybe that big around, and they put it in the sewer line, and it goes, and you're watching the camera go through the tube. And then the scene is you're looking at the bathroom, and the thing pops out of the toilet and then goes down on the ground and slithers over and then peeks around the corner, and they get intel to basically tell the sniper team what to do or whatever. And I remember we all watched this episode in the lab, and we all like, I remember my manager, she freaked out. she's like, ah, DARPA's gonna think that this is possible now and all this stuff. And it was just a bunch of craziness. But so I split my time between robotics and working for the Navy. But you know, it was a big place, and it's very frustrating to work on things and know you're right and tell people like, we shouldn't be doing it this way, and they just ignore you, and then you watch it fail. Yeah. And then you go back to them and see and basically say, hey, I told you so. And you know, it happened all the time, and I wouldn't have lasted. I mean especially now with like this like woke culture that's out there, I'd be written up like nobody's business. I was like getting talked to back then because I didn't want to take any shit from anybody, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember once we went into a meeting, we all had like a certain budget, and I'm here. I had like a pretty low budget for the mechanical engineering development, and I had to pay machine shops to make all this stuff. And, I remember needing more money, and I went into this meeting. And they would review with different groups, like how much they had spent. And a lot of it was like people. So you spent it like how many hours, how many people you had like per month. I remember going into this meeting, and there was a group at that company called packaging. So their job is literally to put components on circuit boards and to worry about like wiring harnesses, right? I remember going into this meeting, and this lady told me that she had, something like 32 people on the project that month. And I questioned her, which she was basically my equal, but I wasn't supposed to be doing that. And I'm like, how do you have 32 people? What the fuck are you guys doing?
Yeah.
Like, seriously. And she's like, oh, well, you know, I can, if you need some people, you know, you can steal some time and we can swap around. And I'm like, No. I want you to answer the question. Like, and she wouldn't do it. And it was just one of these things. It was like, people were definitely charging the number. Yeah. They were, you know, like if a person didn't have a project or whatever, they're like, oh, here's this account, like charge the rest of the hours you need on this. Yeah. It was just a bunch of nonsense, but, it was stuff like that, that absolutely drove me crazy with a place that had so much capability and so much, promise. You know, your hands are tied so much. And also, I hate the physical divide that they put up across all of the engineering disciplines, where it's like mechanical engineering, stay in your lane, electrical engineering, like, let's take all this stuff and throw it over the wall.
Yeah,
it drove me nuts. And I remember on the snake project, it bit them in the ass, because we had designed the transmissions of the snake. It was very, very complicated, but it had basically torsional springs inside of the transmission. Yeah. And it was something that MIT developed in the leg lab, which turned into Boston Dynamics with the humanoid robots and everything. But it's basically a mechanism of, you take a transmission, you have an electric motor, you have a transmission, and you put a spring, you put a sensor on the spring, and you're measuring the outside world and then reacting with the motor and backing off the transmission to basically make like a smart shock, essentially.
Yeah.
And I think we were the first ones to ever develop a rotational version of that, because MIT had done linear ones for their legged robots. But we did this rotational one for the snake with the way it was made. And I remember telling the electrical engineers and the controls guys, like, you have to factor this in. And they like ignored me, like, I was like, no big deal. And somebody had done like an office space divide by 10 error, and the entire snake like crinkled up on itself once. I remember sitting there in the lab, and they were like firing it up for the first time, and it just like, and all you heard was crunch, 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 crunch. And I'm like, yeah, I think you guys just stripped out all the gearboxes in this vehicle.
Wow.
And they're like, what do you mean? And I said, did you guys program in this force sensing? And they're like, no, we didn't think we had to. We don't have time for that. And I'm like, well, the vehicle's not going to work unless you have it.
Yeah.
Well, nobody told us that. I'm like, yes, I have told you that, but you guys aren't listening, you know? So sure as shit, take it apart. There's 32 gearboxes in this vehicle that are failed. And it was a $500 gearbox with $1,000 of machining in our machine shop. And we had to rush order everything and remake all of it. And then, like, these guys still didn't know how to make it work. So we had to take a student that we had from MIT who was phenomenal. And he made this control system work correctly.
Yeah.
And once he implemented it, you could take this snake and drop it from 6 feet and nothing would ever happen, because as the force is coming through the joints, the electronic senses that and would reverse all the motors and absorb the load and then basically like a shock absorber in a car, which was wild. But, you know, it was too many instances of that happening.
Yeah.
And it was nonstop. And it was never any like real recognition. And at this point in time, this was 2006, I think. I had already started running. I was making a mountain bike product called the Roland Logger. We still sell it to this day.
Yeah.
It's a single speed chain tensioner. And we had a lot of orders every month. Like I was sending out shop orders and ordering about 100 at a time from a shop in Illinois. And, you know, I was sending this machine shop about $1,100. And it's a very, very simple part. It's a little like bent piece of aluminum. And, you know, I thought to myself, like, well, this is now 2006. I had acquired the company from I started renting with somebody else. His name's Ken Avery. Yeah. I had acquired the company from him and I was on my own. And I had decided, like, you know, I'm gonna, for $1,100 a month, I could probably finance a machine, a CNC machine, and try making them on my own, you know. I had had some like machine experience, but nothing like, you learn it a little bit. But again, being at these big companies and stuff, they're not going to let the engineer go down and touch $500,000 CNC machine. You know, they pay machinists to take our prints and do that. And we didn't have like flexibility. It was just because it's such a big organization and everybody has their place and everybody sits in their spot and do what you're told kind of thing. And I'm not like that. So I go to a trade show in Massachusetts and check out this brand Haas, which is actually that machine right there.
Yeah.
They had a machine that was pretty affordable for about $32,000. I could buy a machine and like, you know, try to see if this is something I could do. And I was only buying it for that one product, that Roland Logger product.
That's what I was going to ask you. You were only buying it for one product.
Yeah. Yeah.
So were you selling that many pieces of product like that to be able to afford that?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Oh, I mean, definitely I was. But also like thinking things are going to last forever, even though we still do sell them now. But I think we got to a point where we were definitely selling like 1,200 to 1,500 a year. But then the sliding dropout was like introduced into mountain biking, and that like killed like single speed chain tensioner sales, because now you don't need a chain tensioner.
No.
Which is kind of funny. But regardless, like it didn't really matter because I got this machine. Like I like went to the trade show, saw what I wanted. Called them up on Monday and I was like, yeah, I want to buy it. Here's two credit cards. Like I bought it on these credit cards, and 6 weeks later, you know, a tractor trailer shows up in front of my house and this Russian guy like pulls it out and wheels it into the garage of my house, and I wire it up and I literally didn't know how to turn the thing on. Like I had to get the manual and like open it up. I'm like, all right, day one, let's go.
Wow.
But, and it wasn't, you know, it's like anything else. Once you dive into it, you learn it. And I had been doing that my whole life, pretty much. So within 3 nights, I made all the tooling for to make rolling loggers. And I think a production run of 100 pieces would take like 3 or 4 nights after work.
That's and pretty good.
So I'd spend like 1 week at night a month making my production for the rolling loggers.
Yeah.
And then I was like, all right, what can I make next? And naturally, the very first thing that I thought of was making BMX gears.
Okay, hold on. I want to ask you this.
Yeah.
What was it that made you get back into the bike business? Because you'd been out of it for a good while. What was the catalyst for that?
Yeah. So, senior year of high school, stopped racing altogether.
Yeah.
Went to the Worlds in at the end of, like, after I graduated high school in 94. Literally had, like, no riding time. Did super shitty there. Hung the bike up. Like, didn't touch it ever again.
Yeah.
Thought I would never return to bikes. I was going to go do robotics. My very first day of working at Draper, you know, now this is 6 years post ever touching a BMX race. The very first day of work during orientation, I started with this guy. His name is Dave Weigel. And if you like search up his name or research his name, he's the guy that started E13, Evil Bikes. So he had already started a mountain bike company at that time.
Yeah.
And it was kind of funny because, like, we went to lunch on that day. Like, you know, we don't know anybody and there's tons of places to eat in Cambridge. So we go out to lunch and we're just shooting the shit, talking about stuff. And he's like, oh yeah, I have a bike company. I'm like, really? I used to race BMX. And he's like, I ride BMX all the time. I ride it. There's a track that was just north of us called Wakefield BMX.
Yeah.
And I told him, really? I used to race at Wakefield. I said, you know what? I still have a bike. Let's go sometime. Right. So we make plans to show up. And you know, when you go and you see people who say that they know how to ride a bike,
yeah,
and you watch them and you're like, you don't know how to ride a bike.
No.
Like you have no idea. And that's what, to me, that's what he looked like on the BMX track. Now, granted, maybe it was because it was BMX and BMX is kind of specialized and he's trying to ride like a big burly hardtail with front suspension and everything. But I could just tell by his like pedaling and everything. It's like, you haven't spent a lot of time riding a bike, like not competitively at least.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was riding and I'm like, oh man, like, I can't believe like Wakefield's still around. Cause this was a track I raced when I was younger and I only live like maybe 20, 25 minutes away. And I'm like, I've got no homework anymore. I've got like nothing to do. Like, maybe I'm going to give this a shot again. And I went on a Sunday. That's when they had racing. And I remember getting in the gate and I had the old, I had my old cycle craft that I showed up with. So guys are like, holy shit. Like, this is, you know, this is like some vintage piece of crap. But I remember getting in the gate and doing like my old school flat pedal gate start and kind of jumping it, especially at this track, because the gate was like super tiny. And I'm gating with guys that are racing like top tier experts there.
Yeah.
And I'm gating with them and I'm right there. But then like my second pedal's done. And I remember somebody like trying to, it was a friend of mine now, but he was like trying to like help me out. Like, and he's like giving me all these tips and everything. And I remember just saying to myself, like, I'm doing this again. And in 3 years, I'm going to be beating your ass, watch. And I took it super seriously from 2000 to like 2003.
Uh-huh.
And that's, I was going to like a whole bunch of NBL nationals, you know, I had a full-time job, you know, good money. And I chased trying to get number one in my age group, which was, I think it was 21, 24 expert and then 25, 29 expert.
Yeah.
And in 2003, I came the closest and I ended up, crashing. That was like a rained out NBL Grands. I ended up crashing in one of the motos back when moto points mattered more than main points.
Yeah.
And it ruined my chances of getting number one. I ended up with number three and 25-29 expert. And then kind of the downhill, my racing downhill path started at that point. But also what was happening was what was ramping up. I had taken over Wakefield and became track director. I ran that track for 3 years. And at the same time, in 2003, I officially started Renin. So I was trying to race BMX, run a BMX track, and start a business all at the same time.
Yeah.
And in 2003, I had a really bad wrist injury. I broke my scaphoid, and I had decided, and like the people that were helping me at the track, like nobody cared that I broke my wrist. And I was like, hey guys, like I need help. Like I can't like maintain the track with a broken hand. And nobody showed up. And I had to go, like, I remember racing was at like noon, and I'd have to go at like 7 a.m. because I always wanted the track to look good. So I'd sweep it.
Yeah.
And it would take me like 4 hours to sweep the track, and I would sweep it. And then I just stopped, and I was like, all right, I'm going to focus on my racing and Renin. And then in 2005, it hit me that like, I've got to kind of try to give up racing. Like I could ride, but I have to, if I'm going to make Renin into something real, then I have to focus. So,
okay. Let me ask you this. Where did you get the name Renin, and what does it mean?
Yeah. So, I used to be married, and, my ex-wife is German. Yeah. And when I was naming, the company, well, we named the product first. So the Roland Lager is the German word for roller baron.
Okay.
And in the single speed world, it kind of, you know, they all love to like ride bikes and drink beer. So yep. The product sounded good, like Roland Lager, like a beer. So we went with that, and kind of sticking with, like, you know, because I thought about a lot of different company names and stuff, and they seem to follow a trend, like Chris King Cycles, you know, people's names like THE, Toby Henderson Enterprises, stuff like that. Or it's some kind of name like Box or Speedco or whatever. So I was trying to find something like that that had meaning. And I remember we were driving back from BJ's, and I was asking her to translate all these different words. And I said, well, what's the German word for race? And she said, Rennen. And I said, how do you spell that? And she said, R-E-N-N-E-N. I'm like, that's it. That's it. Yeah. Like, I knew it. And told my partner, Ken, at the time. And he was like, yeah, I'm good. Yeah, sounds good to me. He's a marketing guy. He's actually VP of marketing for Vittoria right now.
Wow.
Vittoria Tire. But yeah, it kind of stuck. It has meaning. You know, at heart, I'm a racer. Yeah. And yeah. So...
So tell me this, when it comes to product, I always see it as you have to be, there's a creative mind in there, and you have to draw that product out from hand to writing it down to getting it made. Is your mind one of those that just never stops and it's always thinking of creating something different?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's even worse because like a lot of the stuff that we've done has been like the first of its kind, even if people, a lot, like some of the stuff has been out for so long, people don't even realize it. Like the threaded chain ring, like we created that. And that came from, you know, sitting there and, you know, using the shitty little tool that goes in the back and then machining these things out of aluminum. Like, well, I could just cut the nipple and like thread it. And it's, I eliminate a tolerance and I make gear that's more accurate.
Yeah.
So, and that's a problem that I have because I can't just bring myself to like make something and throw my name on it. I always have to have something on it that, you know, differentiates it. Even if it's like the dumbest thing to other people, it's not dumb to me. Yeah. And that's what all of the things that we've, either invented or innovated on or improved has always been like that. Even the chainring bolt. So I'm sitting next to the lathe right here. This was a $130,000 machine. The very first part that I made on it was a $2.50 chainring bolt, because I had an idea for putting, like, our chainring bolts have underneath the head, it has a little step that most chainring bolts are just threaded all the way up to the head. So when it goes into the spider, the bolt can, like, slide around.
Yeah.
And we put a little tiny nipple underneath the head that locks in to the spider. And that actually makes the entire assembly a lot stiffer and stronger. It strengthens that whole assembly. But I didn't want to go have this made in Asia. So I literally bought this machine to make that one piece. But then again, with the same thing, kind of like when I bought the mill back in 2006, I bought it to make one thing, but then said, all right, well, what else can I make? And that's what a lot of my stuff has been. But it's also, it's problematic because I can't just make, or at least I could, but I don't let myself just make things just to make them.
Yeah.
So, and it takes a long time for development and everything. So,
okay. So that was my next. Okay. But here's my thing. Is it inspiration that you may be doing something and you like, whoa, wait a minute, I think I can do it this way? Or is it something that, you know, you've just been working on over and over again and then you perfect it?
A lot of times it's like problem solving. So like a good story for that is like the creation of decimal gearing. So
that was my next question, decimal.
Yeah. Back in the day when Vintage BMX, rest in peace, when that forum was out, I spent so much time on it. So much paid time on it. I used to be on that forum at Draper all the time, like answering questions and all this stuff. And I remember there was a guy there who had made a post that said, hey, can anybody help me out here? I have, I'm just going to use simple example, like 4416 with a Tioga Comp 3. And I have a cassette wheel and I have a free wheel. And it's the same rim, same tire, same everything. But when I actually roll out on one setup, the bike's traveling about 4 inches further than the other setup. So I was always on there, like, trying to help people out and, like, answer questions and things. And at the time, I was, this was very early on. So decimal gearing, I want to say it might have been like 2008 or so. I was on like the daily basis, like pads of paper, writing out equations, like breaking things down like that. I basically took this guy's problem and worked it in reverse. And I had,
it's amazing.
I basically said, okay, what is going to change here? The only thing that changed was the rear cog. It was a cog or a free wheel. So I put a parameter on it to work all the numbers backwards, and it figured that if the rear cog to the free wheel had a difference of only 20 thousandths of an inch, that was enough to produce the 4 inches that this guy had in rollout. And I remember writing the solution. I posted it and the guy was like, cool, yeah, that makes sense. And then I remember I was on an airplane going to Chula for one of the first, I think it was like one of the first Supercross races. And I have it in my notebook, like, wait a second here. If I can, instead of the cog, do this on the front. And what I was really trying to get was 0.5.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, like, if I could get 0.5, I have the holy grail. Like, this is what people want. So I wrote out all this stuff in my notebook and then came back immediately, like literally like whatever the day was. And I came into the shop, I got on my CAD package immediately, drew it up, drew out a 0.5, posted all of the code, brought it over to Sean Dupree. Was like, Sean, run this file right now. Sean has worked for me for a long time.
Yeah.
He used to make gears. We make the first one, try wrapping a chain around. It only wrapped around like maybe a few teeth. And I'm like, damn it. So I'm like, all right, maybe 0.4. Redraw it, go out. Kept on doing that. And I'm getting closer. I'm getting more chain wrap and more chain wrap.
Yeah.
Then I got to 0.2 and I had over 180 degrees of wrap. And I'm like, I did it. I got it. So, and then proceeded to make 0.1, 0.9, 0.8, 0.7, 0.6. It starts getting real sketchy.
Yeah.
So I stopped there and decimal gearing was born at that point, and did a big production run. Went to Reno for the season opener. I think it might have been 08. And everything I brought with me sold out. I think I did a podcast with Mike Carruth and talked about it and said like this was going to release this weekend. Just sold everything and it was all gone. And that's really where we went from like hobby to like real business. So,
wow. So has the demand for decimal stayed where it stayed, or has it continued to grow?
It's just continued to grow. Yeah. And if it wasn't for Facebook Marketplace, we'd be bigger than what we are. Cause like, I'm still like shocked. I just saw somebody the other day posted up like 20 threaded gears, all kinds of decimal sizes and stuff for $45 a piece. And the current retail price on them is 60. That guy that posted that, if he's had them for a long time, probably is barely losing any money on it or made money on it. Because I shouldn't say that. Like when we first came out with 4-bolt threaded gears, they sold for $45. And over the years, because of material pricing and stuff, it's gone up to 60. But like, it is actually something that if you bought it in 2008 and you bought it for $45, and here we are in 2023 and people are like reselling for 45, it still blows my mind. It's Facebook Marketplace definitely has taken like a big chunk, but at the same time, it gives people the opportunity to get into the product. And cause maybe, I mean, our stuff is expensive, and a new family, you know, I definitely sympathize with that. So yeah, go try the waters and try out some stuff and then come to us when you want to buy a brand new one or something, or one of our vendors or whoever. So,
Okay. So here's my question. When it comes to like the chain ring, market, is it flooded? Is it incredibly competitive?
I mean, I don't know other people's numbers, so yes, it's kind of hard to figure out. But my gauge of like where everybody's at for the most part is when you go to J&R Bikes and when you go to Grands and you go to J&R Bikes and you look at the wall, right? We occupy 75% of that wall for gearing, and there might be a strip of somebody else, a strip of somebody else, but the majority of the stuff is Renin, and it's mainly Renin decimal. I'm sure that collectively, like the lower end ones, the entry level stuff is probably a really high number too, but I don't know what those numbers are. We don't make anything like that. We don't make an entry level product. I would say it's competitive in the fact that every couple of years, somebody is like, I'm going to get into it. Yeah. And then they fizzle out. Or this is not easy. Like I could be making so much more money if I just like would bite my lip and go work for somebody else and go do some engineering job or something. But I mean, this is something that, you know, I'm physically doing it, but like, I would have grown old saying, oh man, you know, I had this idea once, or if I could have did this, or, you know, and we've had things that have been, you know, total disasters, that are super complicated products like GCOG. I mean, that thing soaked up so much of my time that I'm never going to get back. But what it did for us is buy us a lot of like technical clout. And like, there's nobody in the sport that's done that, you know, nobody can talk to it. You know,
that's your power meter, correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I was.
Yeah. That was, yeah, I actually, that was the reason why I started Renin originally. It wasn't that mountain bike product. That mountain bike product was my partner Ken's idea, but I have a design notebook in 2003 on my birthday, where I wrote down, like, I was going to make a BMX power meter, and it was going to be a hub originally. And I wanted it for myself for, cause I was, you know, training and trying to get better and everything. And, but that product took 5 years of like just nightly development and trying to get it working. And in 2008, we released it, and, you know, it's a very complicated, and it was expensive too, but it had to be expensive for everything that we did with it. And to this day, we sold the last one, and, or I mean, the last one that was like officially sold. I still have units here, and I have a bunch of components to build them up, although none of our calibration and test equipment is functional right now. But the last one was sold in like 2014. And, but it was just one of these things. It was kind of funny because I think it was Colin Stiles who said when he first saw it, he was like, I think this is too advanced for BMX right now. And he's a little cynical anyway. It's just how he always is. But I remember being like, come on, man, like stop shitting on this. Like I worked hard. You know? But like that was like an engineer's product. It was like an engineer's dream. But unfortunately, not everyone's an engineer. So it was. You know, there was a lot of there isn't a bicycle specific power meter data acquisition device to this day that does as much as we did.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Okay. There is a product that I'm curious about, if you don't mind me asking.
Yeah.
And I wrote this
down. I got all the time in the world. So,
it is the adjustable crank for kids. Where in the hell did you come up with that? Because I find that quite interesting.
Yeah. So, it's not unique. It has been done in the past. Yeah. It was done in like the 1800s. I have a few, antique bicycles, and I have up there. Yeah. I have, also some antique bicycle engineering texts. And from like the 1880s, and there's examples of adjustable cranks in those textbooks and stuff. And anybody who gets a chance to go to the Bicycle Museum of America, it's in New Bremen, Ohio. Mm-hmm. Awesome. That museum has tons of examples of unique things like this. But in BMX, I have to, you know, shout out and talk about this person out of Colorado. Was I guess it was a brand called SS Cranks, but it was started by this guy Sid McMullen, whose son had raced for Redmond at the time, and they came out with this crank. It came out with a crank that was adjustable. It was a much different design from what I have, and they offered it. It was mainly something that he was making, I think, for his team, but they did make them and sell them and stuff like that. Tragically, Sid's son passed away, and right around that time, I think it was right before his son passed, I had reached out to them about possibly, because at this point the product was like not in circulation, not being sold, not anything. And I reached out to him about possibly like taking over that product and integrating it in. And, like there was like some positive talks and everything. And then his son passed. And I was like, ugh, so like, this is not a good time. And then, but he still wanted to talk at Grands. And so we had a conversation at Grands about it and stuff. And I had wanted a lot more details about like the manufacturing, the, you know, all like everything business-wise that you would ask for it. And it just never came to be. And, you know, I just kind of didn't want to go down that path anymore.
Yes, sir.
But then I still had this idea of like, well, how would I do it? Especially back then, the smallest crank size you could get was like a 135. And, you know, in the last like 10 years, we've had the advent of these very small cranks down to like even 85 millimeters. But our adjustable crank is 90 millimeter to 160 in 2.5 millimeter increments. So it was one of these things that I sat down. I'm like, all right, this is my goal. This is what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to make a crank that covers this entire range. It needs to be simple to install. How could I do it? And kind of, you know, what we have nowadays is what, and again, like, how am I going to make it?
Yeah.
The lathe that I had bought is a multi-axis. It's kind of like having a milling machine and two lathes combined.
Yeah.
We make that product in this machine. And it's great because we can flip it over, machine both sides. Like almost the entire thing is machined in one step. And then we get these like very little small nubs at the end that get broken off and sanded. But that's how that product's made essentially. And all the internal parts are made on the lathe also. But yeah, that was like the origin story of it, was trying to work with a different, you know, product that had existed. Yeah. But then just circumstances of life kind of got in the way. And then
yeah.
I didn't have a good manufacturing facility to even make that product. But then once I built this building and acquired the lathe and everything, then I started spinning up all these ideas that I've had on the chopping blocks, or not in the chopping block, but in the design notebook. So
have you ever considered going into the direction of handlebars to stems?
We make a stem currently. We make a little kid stem. Yeah. It's the lightest on the market. So it's called ultralight stem. Yeah, certainly I have ideas for lots of things. It's just, you know, I don't want to like outsource anything that we're doing, and I want to do it in-house. And there's pros and cons to it. But there's only so many types of things that I can do at this time with the equipment that I have right now. But we do have a lot of equipment, and we're very capable of making lots of things.
Yeah.
So, but a big kind of direction that the company went in was when my son was born, and I was, you know, getting super excited about making him his first bike and everything. I went through the process of building him a first little pedal bike. And I had wanted to make this thing that was like super light. And yeah. I remember I spent so much time, like making all this stuff for it and modifying things. And, only had ever gotten that bike down to 7 pounds, 1 ounce. And I know I say only, I know that's very light.
Yeah.
But, I talked about this on my podcast yesterday. There's going to be a feature in an upcoming Pull magazine with that same bike that I did, but upgraded with modern capabilities and new ideas that I've put into that bike.
Yeah.
And I shatter the 7 pound, 1 ounce weight for the complete bike. It's super, super cool. But like something that I talked about on my podcast, so I don't mind mentioning it here, is probably at the beginning of January, 10 years ago when my son was born and I was building this bike, I attempted to make an aluminum chain because that's like one of the things on the bike that's super hard to cut weight on.
Yeah.
And there's titanium chains you could buy. You save some weight, you don't save a ton. But, you know, if you can make something out of aluminum, it's a third the density of steel. Yeah. So you could really cut a bunch out. And I had tried unsuccessfully. 10 years ago, kind of had to stop myself from like working on it anymore. Cause I was like, we weren't even we only had two machines at the time, and we weren't even keeping up with orders back then. And I'm like dicking around trying to make this other stuff. And I'm like, man, I gotta stop. But everything stayed and like shelved. And then when George Vick invited me to do this build and said, hey, if you want to submit something, now's the time. And I'm like, I need a couple of months, man. I got some ideas. I successfully have made an aluminum CNC chain that is on this bike build. And it's a little tiny gear setup. So it's like a 30, like 12 or something like that with 18 inch wheels. But the chain only weighs like 60 grams. And normally it'd be like 154. So it's about like 100 gram savings, quarter of a pound off the bike just by doing that.
Holy cow.
Okay, yeah.
Tell me this. You've sponsored quite a few teams in your time.
Yeah.
Intense Renin?
It was Renin Intense.
Renin Intense.
Yeah.
And then the big one that I when I first got back into racing, the team that I heard was Answer Renin.
Yes.
That was the one with, and the person that I remember the most is Derek Berg.
Yeah. Yeah.
From Minnesota.
You're from Minnesota. So
yes,
there you go.
Yes,
there's
sir.
That connection. Yeah.
Did you enjoy the sponsorship aspect of the team, or was it a pain in the butt as a business owner?
It was both. I mean, I did enjoy it. Like there's so many stories from those days and it was just so good. But there's also so many stories from those days where it was like so bad. So, you know, it's like, I love to think back and reminisce and think about like, I should get back into it, you know, and do it again. But,
that was my next question.
Yeah. But then I kind of hit reality and think about like what happened during that time period. So although we had like, you know, we did this big sponsorship and managing, you know, we had up to like 22 people at one point on Answer Renin.
Yeah.
Obviously, like we were very successful winning 2 Golden Cranks, 2 team titles, 4 national number one amateurs on that team, multiple NAG One riders. It was 8 seasons of having like another full-time job. And during that time period, I think I had 2 products I developed. And it was, one was on my son's bike, the race light gear, because I needed to make a super light gear. Ended up making that. And the other, I think, was It Wheel. And, you know, it gets to a certain point after winning the titles. If I never won the title, I don't know if I'd still be doing it, but never say never. Like I probably, because I'm dumb enough, like I'd probably be continue doing it. But after winning the titles, I was like, all right, I'll try to keep this going for as long as I can. But if I lose, I'm probably done, because we weren't seeing any. You know, we could have kept on winning titles. It wouldn't have affected, you know, sales.
Okay. That's the question I wanted to ask you. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but that's the one thing I'm curious about. Having a team, did you see having such a successful team make a reflection into the sales of your product?
I believe so, yes. But it was like the ramp up. So from 2011 to probably 2015, like that was the ramp up.
Yeah.
But then it got to the point and it was capped. And why was it capped? Because I only have so many products. So if I don't have more products, you're not going to sell more stuff. So the very first year in 2009, the team ended in 2018, 2019, I was moved into this facility, had acquired just one additional CNC machine, the lathe. But on this one machine, we developed 6 new products in 1 year. And that's when things started, you know, going up. Mm-hmm. 2019 was better than all my prior years. And then the COVID years were even better than 2019. So
really,
like, yeah. With no sponsorship. Like I literally dropped down to nothing. Like the only thing that I did was, you know, like we've always sponsored the Answer team. We've always sponsored any team Jim Buchanan's done, whether it'd been Throwdown or S Squared or, you know, any of his things.
Yeah.
There's lots of teams that we co-sponsor, but certainly a lot of pros that ask us for the hookup and we give it to them. But none of that shit matters in my mind right now. Like, what matters more is that we make a good product, we have good customer service, and we keep on developing things that people want. I think that's the most important thing for any business. And I tell people all the time, I'm pretty brutal, because I feel like when I watch these podcasts or interviews with other people, they always talk about the way things always have been and the way that things are. And that's like, that's the path you should go down. And I'm totally opposite. I don't think a lot of that shit doesn't work, in my opinion. Like, if it works, show me data, show me backup, like prove to me that it works.
Yeah.
Cause the data I have shows that it doesn't. So it does to a certain extent. Like, if you're trying to build up your brand, trying to build up your name, you know, do that kind of stuff. But, you know, the biggest mistake that people make, I think, is people who start brands because they have a team. And like, the brand takes on the identity of the team, and the brand only exists for the team to exist. That ain't the way it should work. And that's one of the problems with BMX that we have right now, is that BMX is fractured in that regard. In that there's too much shit that's out there and not enough people to buy stuff.
Okay. That was my next question, because I'm thinking, and I'm not asking your money. That's not my business. I'm just curious of, is it tough to make a living, to sustain a business in a BM, in a niche sport, as many people like to say, even though it's worldwide?
Yeah.
Is it tough?
Yeah, it's definitely tough. Yeah. I mean, there's a million different ways of like having a better living, for sure. Are you going to be able to do that in my position, to where like when we started this, like the first thing you asked was would it be okay to call me like this mad genius, which is flattering. I thank you for thinking that. But like, am I going to be like that in some other industry? You know, you have to cut your teeth in that. You know, I've been doing this shit since I was 9 years old. Yeah. You know, and I was making stuff when I was a kid, and I taught myself how to build wheels at 11. And, you know, so like, bikes is just something I just naturally know. And like, I feel like when I do explain things to people from like an engineering perspective, they understand it and they believe it. I try to do this sort of thing with like the parents on my son's baseball team, and they just look at me cross-eyed, like, because I never played baseball when I was a kid. And I'm like, you guys are side story, but like, baseball parents, super annoying. But I mean, you know, there's definitely much better ways to earn a living. Just like, if you're a BMX pro, there's much better ways to earn a living than trying to be a BMX pro. But, you know, for those ones that have achieved the top of the mountain, you know, are you going to get that in something else in your life? Hopefully you take the lessons that you learned in BMX and you apply it to other things that you want to do.
Yeah.
And that's what I did in school. I took everything that I kind of learned in BMX and applied it to school and to work. Sometimes it doesn't work out so well. Like, you can't really be going to work and trying to talk shit to your boss and stuff like that. But you know, I mean, I would never change anything. And I have like this life that, you know, I just have full freedom on whatever I want to do. And I'm living the way I want to live. And I, more importantly, like, my only goal is to really try to give my kids a super head start on their lives. Yeah. And I don't care if they go to school. I don't care if they, you know, it doesn't really matter what they do. I just want them to know that if they apply themselves, they can do pretty much anything that they want. Yeah. And I'm trying to put them in scenarios to do that, whether they want to, you know, take the business over and like continue the legacy when I'm done, or if they want to branch off and do something different. I mean, you know, or if they just want to go a completely different route.
Yeah.
But knowing that I have a massive cheat sheet for them to follow, which I had to cut my teeth. I had nobody to help me with that. Yeah. The only thing I had was my parents, you know, as stupid as it sounds, like asking for an allowance. And my dad's like, oh yeah, you want an allowance? Like, I'll get you a fucking paper route. Like, how about that? Yeah. You know?
Yeah. So. Wow. Okay. Last couple of questions here. I'm curious about your facility. How big is it? And how often are you running? Are you running 6-7 days a week?
We're about 2,400 square feet. So it's a 40 by 60 building. There's 5 CNC machines here. Currently, there's 3 people working in here, including me. We definitely could be running a lot more, but to be honest, like we're running like what we need to do. And I'm also trying to work on development. So it's difficult to do production and prototyping at the same time because you need equipment to prototype on. So I could, if I found the right people that wanted to work here, we could easily hire like 2 more, maybe 3 more people. But right now I'm just, I've had some people that have come in that are friends that say they want to like, they, it sounds like a super cool thing. And it's definitely like a blast. I can't say it's a ton of fun to be here, but, for whatever reason, like we've had a little bit of turnover in the last like couple of years. So I just have kind of stopped. I actually gave a kid, a BMX kid, last, November, December, don't really know him. I mean, I know him now, obviously, but like, it's a kid from my local track. I would just see him at the local track and I'd get on the gate and I'd try to beat him. He's 15 years old and he's fast. And I'm trying to like put old man speed down on a cruiser. And then one day I'm driving back from my parents' house and I get this Facebook message and he's like, hey, you looking for somebody? You looking to hire anybody? And, you know, we went back and forth a little bit and I was like, don't you live kind of far? Cause I thought he lived like a lot further away. And he's like, no, my parents will drive me to your place and I'm homeschooled and I get my homeschool stuff done on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So when I asked him like what kind of schedule he wants to work, he said he would work 3 days a week, full time, like 8 hours a day.
Wow.
And I was like, yeah, I mean, if you want to, that'd be cool. I said, when can you start? And this was on a Sunday and he turned around and told me, I could start tomorrow morning, 8 a.m. I'm like, you're hired. And he's been here ever since. And wow. He's going to be full time this summer. And he's awesome. Like he's 100% like he's 15 years old and he's one of the most productive employees I've ever had. So shout out Escher.
Not bad. George, what do you have cooking? If you can reveal anything, what do you have in the cooker?
I think it's a mistake to like people who talk about new products that they have. If your release schedule doesn't go the right way, you start getting hounded and, it kind of works negatively. So we do have, I mean, there should be something, it's in testing now. It should be released relatively soon. I'm hoping by like, we have a national at our local track here on Cape Cod this summer in August. And I'm hoping that definitely by then, like we have it for sale and available. But in the next couple of months, it'll be ready to go. It's a new product that we have. If there's any kind of reveal, it's for younger kids. It's going to be one of the lightest things made for younger kids. And that's kind of the, you know, the shtick that we have with what we've got going on, everything that we make for the most part is the lightest stuff in BMX and it's engineered and tested. And so, yeah.
Okay. My last question to you, George Costa, is this. Does BMX still give you that joy, that spark that you had when you first got into it?
I think it gives me a different kind. So I don't really have a desire to go like train and like chase down people. And I like going to the track. I like doing first straights. I don't have like the energy to do like full track anymore. I do like going and trying to, you know, jump and stuff like that. Like Sean Dupree, who works for me, is like head over heels and mountain biking and dirt jumping and stuff like that. And
total badass.
he convinced a bunch of us to go to another former racer, Scott Meckler in Pennsylvania, has a sick backyard track set up, like backyard track trails. And we went there last weekend and had a blast. But I also, you know, I haven't ridden since September. And the last time I rode, I got a concussion at the local track. And then this past weekend, I had gotten through one section of the trails and everyone's cheering. I'm like feeling good about myself. I sat down because my knee was hurting, got back up. I went up to the top of the start. I go through one jump and then fully launched my bike off the second. It probably went 50 feet in the air, stomped the face of the lip, sprained my ankle. Like, and then that's when I'm like, yeah, this shit is, you know, this is when I get like tired of it. But, you know, my friends in BMX are the friends I've had, you know, for 30 years. And even new people that you meet, you know, it's just, they're just such good people. And it doesn't matter what they do, like their backgrounds, like we all just get along. So that's the stuff I love about BMX. And, you know, it's just great. So, but the industry stuff keeps me. I have that desire and fire to, you know, I get enjoyment out of making things that people have never made before, coming up with stuff that people have never made, like this bike that I built that hopefully is featured soon. When you see the weight, it's pretty impressive. So yeah, doing stuff like that keeps me going for sure.
Not bad. George Costa, I want to say thank you again. I really appreciate the time that I got to get to know you. The person behind the iconic, I would say, company. So thank you.